Good afternoon and welcome to the conference, and thank you everyone for coming. It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce Rabbi Katz. Rabbi David Katz is the director of Mechlelet Mevaser Yerushalayim and has been with MNY since its inception 20 years ago. Rabbi Katz studied at Yeshiva University in New York and Yeshiva Torah Moshe in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Katz is an extremely popular teacher, in particular his classes on the halachic process, and has lectured extensively not only in seminary but with teenagers and adults alike in communities and summer camps throughout the United States, United Kingdom, South Africa, and Australia. Originally from Teaneck, New Jersey, Rabbi Katz made Aliyah in 1989, is a father of six and proud grandfather of three, and presently lives with his family in Ramat Beit Shemesh. I'm privileged to introduce today's presentation, Functional Illiteracy and Edutainment, in quotes, Balancing Substance and Excitement in Our Classrooms. Thank you, Rabbi Katz.
You're welcome. I'm glad you said in quotes, because the people on the recording otherwise wouldn't get the thing. I'm going to stand here. It's a smaller crowd, so if the recording, I assume it'll be fine. Okay, we only got a half hour, so that's what we get to do. I gave you a sheet. We're going to start with the other side of the sheet, the non-list, the letter, if you will, the several paragraphs. What we're doing now can be, I'm doing the 30-minute version of otherwise what I normally do is a 90-minute sicha in MMY, so we're going to have to shrink it down. You can see the larger discussion, credit where credit is due, on the LookGen Educators site. Ellie Lassen is familiar with that site. I read your postings all the time. The Lookstein Center has a thing called LookGen, and you can see these postings and the discussion surrounding it in larger fashion.
Can you spell the site?
LookGen, LookJed. Can you Google it? I'm sure you'll find it. The following question was of Jewish educators was posed on this list many, many years ago. You have it in front of you. Just for the sake of the recording, I'll read it. I'm teaching 11th grade Chumash in a modern Orthodox high school. This year we're studying Sefer Dvarim. In the first semester, I have covered, in quotes, the first 11 prakim. I don't read much inside, but instead I have them read a perek at Homer and Shir with guided questions. Class is generally focused on a theme, and discussion revolves around this theme. At the end of the semester, I announce the final will cover those 11 prakim, and part of the test will include psukim, which they will have to translate and give the context. A student came over to me afterwards and said, "Rabbi, I can't take your final. I don't understand Hebrew. I can barely read a pasuk." He was amazed that I could actually follow along during Torah reading on Shabbat and understand what's being said. I tested him on a few psukim and saw he wasn't lying. He could not make out prefixes, suffixes, roots, etc. What should my goal be with this student? Should I change what I do in class? What about those students who can read Chumash on their own? My answer to the student was to focus on five prakim and know those well, i.e. translation and context. I don't want to give up on teaching my class through a theme-based discussion and turning this into a pasuk-by-pasuk translation class. Is that the right answer? That was the question that was posed. Now, if I was giving this in the longer version, I would ask the audience what they think, what they would advise this teacher, and inevitably there would be different opinions. Some would feel that focusing on five prakim doesn't make any sense. If he can't read prakim, he can't read 10 prakim, he can't read five prakim, so instead we need to focus with him perhaps on his remedial reading skills. If he's the aberration, we need to pull that student out of class, etc. Or perhaps there would be a lively discussion of pros and cons of different approaches. We don't have the time for that, so I'm going to share with you one particular approach that was listed. I'll just read you the logic here. First the background. This one particular educator responded, "You raise a great question. We need to analyze what our goals are in the classroom in the first place in order to answer this question. So we need to take a step out and say, what are our goals in this classroom, in education in general? And then, how should we guide you for helping this student and your other students as well?" So I'll just read you the relevant paragraph here. "I'm glad to see that the issue of functional illiteracy among yeshiva graduates has been raised. Having been involved in four very different yeshiva high schools over the past two decades, I have no doubt that a significant portion of yeshiva high school graduates are functionally illiterate. If we define it as the ability to read a passage from Ramban's Torah commentary or a Daf Gemara, the question I pose is, what should be the realistic expectations of students studying complex texts in a non-native language and what the goals of yeshiva education should be? If I were to use math as an analogy, the goal of a high school education is not to produce mathematicians, but to introduce the field of higher mathematics to the broader population, give the students the fundamental tools with which they can explore math on a higher level should they choose to, and provide the inspiration so that some students will indeed pursue advanced mathematics. I suspect that the survey of high school graduates who have no intention of pursuing a course of study which requires advanced mathematical skills will retain much more than rudimentary algebra and a little geometry. Were we to apply the same standard to other subjects, such as history or the sciences, I believe we would find the results somewhat similar. This, of course, despite the fact that these subjects are being taught in a native language. Despite this, I don't believe we would consider these students as being functionally illiterate in these areas. Because for the masses, there's no realistic expectation that these students would have mastered these skills. Honestly, how many LookJet readers remember the difference between molarity and molality, or how to determine the height of a building using trigonometry, etc., etc., etc.? And what he does in this post, and now you can flip over your sheet, is he suggests a list of 13 goals. And again, you can read them on your own. Sorry on the recording there. But basically, they go from the more amorphous to the more textual to the more specific. And he says we need to look at our goals of education on a spectrum. Although we would love to have all of these goals, who wouldn't want all of these goals? You're paying tuition dollars. You want, you know, $5,000 a goal. You want to have goals for each one, for all of these. You want them to be the goal of your children's classroom. But there's one thing tuition dollars cannot buy, and that's more time. There is still a finite amount of time, no matter how much tuition rises. And therefore, we have no choice within 38-minute periods, etc., to determine our goals and to say where we're willing, despite us wanting them all, to cut them. And again, if this was in the longer version, I would ask you, and I do this in school, I have the girls all, we discuss back and forth where they think we should draw the line. I have to convince them, remember, they're kids, so they don't get it when I say, no, you have to draw the line because you have infinite resources. They're teenagers. They think still that there's endless resources. So, you have to cut the list at some point, and I save from year to year the different students' responses, and I look for trends. So over the last 15 years, I have the, again, it's only my one school. It's not scientifically, statistically relevant, but looking for trends. And unfortunately, we don't have time to do that in this audience. On the site, and in general, I find number 8 is on average where people are willing, despite the difficulty in doing so, are willing to cut the list. So if you look at where number 8 is on the list, give or take, and again, we could debate this list, and we could say that the list is a bad list, and there should be a different list, and that number 13 should really be number 3, and number 3 should really be number 5, or whatever the case may be. But let's work with the number 8. And you'll notice, therefore, if goal number 1, 2, 3, 4 are more amorphous, they should have positive feelings about their Jewish identity, they should explore their Jewish identity, they should be committed to fundamental values of Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, they should be participants, committed to be participants in their communal institutions, they should be committed to being Shomer Torah Mitzvot, etc. And then number 8, graduate, where we're going to draw the line, graduates should be prepared to devote time post-graduation to continue their Jewish learning in a formal environment. Beautiful goal. So we're going to sadly and painfully cut the list there. And then the other goals, which are goals. But Nebuch, we may not be able to achieve them, and we may have to settle at that point, because that's life. Graduates should have language skills, critical thinking skills, the ability to analyze a text, to be able to research questions, find the appropriate sources, to know what they don't know and know how to find, etc. Those goals, unfortunately, again, as part of our discussion, those become the secondary goal. Because we can't do everything, and we only have 38 minutes in the classroom, we only have 180 days in the school year, we have extracurriculars, we have secular subjects, we have multiple things that we need to accomplish. Anyway, this was the discussion on the list. I now hand you the reaction. The reaction to this suggestion of this list in particular and then cutting it at number 8 was not far to come. The analogy was, if you're making the analogy to our secular subjects, if you're saying that in math we would have this goal and this goal, and in history we would have this goal and this goal, and therefore let's do the same thing in our Jewish studies, and Nebuch we're going to have to cut our goals at number 8, the response to that would be the following analogous list of goals for our secular education. And this I will read because I just love this. 1, graduates should have positive feelings about their American identity. 2, graduates should be open to continue to explore that sense of American identity beyond their formal schooling. 3, graduates should be committed to the fundamental values of democracy and justice. 4, graduates should know how to function as active participants in their American communities and criminal institutions. 5, graduates should be committed to function as active participants in their American communities. 1 is to know how and to be committed to. They sound very similar, but fine. 6, graduates should be committed to a life of good citizenship and allegiance to the law. 7, graduates should appreciate the value of continued learning and be committed to incorporate some form of learning, be it lectures, tapes, or educational television, into their adult lives, Or an 8, where we're cutting the list, graduates should be prepared to devote time post-graduation to continue their learning in a formal environment. As parents of students now in a secular education system, what would your reaction be if the principal suggested, given the time constraints, that that is where we cut the list of our goals for their education? You'd be proud of that? Okay. I can only share with you the response on site. Again, please look at the larger discussion. We'd be glad the graduates were productive citizens and not the hoodlums, to be sure, but we'd look for another principal. Now, you can disagree, and that's fine, but it's food for thought. Are we setting goals appropriately in our Jewish education of our students that match the goals that we have for them in their secular education? And now you will claim, but those two fields are not the same, because in their secular studies, there's a certain goal achievement that they must have in order to get into higher education. They must get into higher education because in our society, that is the tool for parnassa. And parnassa and family and shalom and everything else revolves around all of that ability. However, in their Judaic studies, who says that our goals need to be the same? Perhaps our goals for Judaic studies should be that they walk out of their Judaic studies classroom touchy-feely, feeling good about their relationship with God. And it isn't therefore, so this whole exercise perhaps is false by its very premise. One can certainly claim that. However, and in fact, by the way, yesterday I was in Camp Lo Shabbat for Shabbos. We did a Q&A, a question and answer session with the boys and the girls on the BMP and the Beit Midrash program. One of the boys asked, they're teaching, these are kids just back from Israel, they're teaching Eda Hay. Eda Hay is like 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds. And he wanted some advice for teaching them. The rabbi that was sitting with me on the panel, it was a panel, he basically said, your goal for the summer with these little kids is that they should walk out of summer camp feeling good about learning Torah. Now, I can't argue with that. I can argue with that, and I did argue with that. But I can understand why one wouldn't feel the need to argue with that. What else do we want our kids to walk out from their Torah component of their summer camp experience? But we're not talking about summer camp now. We're talking about school. So I just want to share with you a little bit more from the Lookjed site, two particular quotes that I think are pointed on this. There's a yeshiva kedosha, well, let me read that correctly. There's a yeshiva kedosha in my neighborhood that has a regents track to accommodate those parents who have not yet been convinced that there's no real value in having a high school diploma in our society. They study English literature in class from Cliff Notes, not the original text. They're being prepared to be able to discuss the book on the regents exam without wasting time on reading the book itself. It would be a mistake to assume that this disdain for the text is not being conveyed to students who are told they can discuss Chumash without access to the original text. Of course, the teacher who wrote that original question would prefer interesting discussions to drill in reading and grammar. Who wouldn't? But he's in this fix because all the teachers before him had the same attitude. What would he do if he found out that discussions in his English literature class were based on Wishbone, a great elementary school TV show that introduces young children to famous books by way of a talking dog, because the students couldn't read the books under discussion, or if he found that the students in his math class were discussing logical proofs but couldn't add fractions? I would hope that he would address the real deficiency. And I'll just share one other pointed quote on this, which I add for the food to thought before I suggest perhaps some solutions on the assumption that I've expressed the problem fairly. Is this illiteracy part of the problem of religious dropouts? It's hardly the main part of the problem, but I think it's a significant part. When students eventually confront serious learning, and that is what happens in good secular universities, they realize that the same intellectual demands required of them in college were not made in yeshiva. No math teacher lets them talk about how to do the problem without demanding they do it correctly. No French teacher lets them walk into class with a translation of the text under discussion. No philosophy teacher allows a discussion without making sure that the text was read. Is there no conclusion for them to draw from the fact that their Jewish studies teachers tried to sell the lack of intellectual demands as good pedagogy? And then, the last quote that I'll read, and by the way, in school, when I do this, this is the quote that I focus on, and I run a text-based school, but nonetheless, this is a culture. It is a culture that our kids are growing up with. It's a culture they're growing up in our Jewish community, but it's also a culture they're growing up with in society as a whole. Remember when we did research projects in high school, index cards, library? Now they're trained, Google, cut, paste. Now, there are skills to Google and cut paste, and I don't minimize those skills either. And, you know, some of us old people here, and by that I only mean me, but some of us old people now, who unfortunately aren't as good as the Google cut paste, that's a skill that we're lacking, and it would be good if I, you know, can learn new tricks as well. However, we're living in a different world, so it isn't just our Jewish community, and we have to understand that when we try to solve what I'm promoting as a problem. But Hashgafic discussions, even when held on class time, are effective educational tools. But when they become a substitute for the hard work of mastering a subject, they constitute educational malpractice. No pain, no gain is no longer the motto of secular education in our society. Our Rebbeim have unfortunately bought into this new attitude. And there's no question, based on the culture around us in general, in terms of education, the fact that our secular education has become extremely goal, career, metrics, therefore grade, metrics, focused, because the things sapping our time, the legitimate things, I'm not talking about the wasted time that we all spend on our smartphones and on our Facebooks and all of that. I'm talking about the things that are sapping our time in terms of extracurricular activities that you need to round out a resume now to get into college, especially in the competitive colleges, that's what people want to see, and the competition for internships, and the kids can't know, you know, sit and learn in the summer anymore like they used to, because if you're in college, you've got to be building your resume and internships, etc. All these things are true. But we also have to recognize the downside that that creates. And the downside that that creates is a society that we present to our children, in my humble opinion, a disdain for text, which is going to hamper their ability to function as full-fledged Jews. You are not attending Rabbi Goldman's session about Tfilah, but in the post conference and TNET conversation that we had with Rabbi Goldman's in the hallway right after we both spoke at the last session, that was one of the things that came up. How do you expect kids to daven if they can't understand the words? Well, they can't understand the words because they don't know Hebrew. And they don't know Hebrew because they haven't been trained in Hebrew. And they haven't been trained in Hebrew because training in Hebrew is not fun. It's not entertaining, edutaining. It's hard work. And again, the goal is not to point blame because, you know, us, the seminaries, we blame the high schools, and the high schools blame the elementary schools. And by the way, that's who the elementary schools blame.
No, we blame the preschool.
The preschool.
The
parents. I don't get that. I'll tell you the actual story. I was once in an elementary school. I don't usually dabble in elementary schools, but coincidentally, I was in an elementary school, and the principal, the headmaster, the head of school of the elementary school, whose daughter happened to go to MMY, so he said to me, I have one bone to pick with you. I'm wondering what it is. Was it the food? Was it your bed? Was it this? What was the one bone? He's talking to me as an educator. He said, you're not sending us graduates of your seminary and seminaries in general who can teach Yivrit B'Yivrit. And therefore, we can't teach Yivrit B'Yivrit because you're not sending us graduates that are teaching Yivrit B'Yivrit. I said, I can't teach Yivrit B'Yivrit because the high schools aren't sending me kids who are interested in Yivrit B'Yivrit or can handle it. So I then go to the high school, I tell them this story, and I say to them, you know, you, the high schools, you're not, and guess what they respond? But the elementary schools. So we've got a vicious cycle. We've got a vicious cycle that somehow has to come to an end, and this is the problem. I don't want to focus on the problems. I'll take questions afterwards, I think it'll be easier. I'm going to leave time for it, I'm good like that. Let's just take a look. Okay. I'm right on time. I just want to suggest several little solutions to the problem, or bricks towards solutions to the problem, and I leave them as food for thought. The premise of my solutions, though, is that we can't change a culture overnight. This isn't the problem of the curriculum in a particular school or a particular high school. This is a cultural phenomenon outside of the Jewish community as well, and therefore it needs cultural solutions. But cultural solutions, when you're fighting the overall culture, are slow, and therefore happen in small little steps. So I want to suggest some small little steps that start at home in our own families, with our own children, our own grandchildren, etc. Number one, subliminal messages. I think our educational system starts with subliminal messages. This morning at the keynote address in TNEC, I will use as an example, Shani Tarragon, who's speaking in another room right now, she gave the keynote address to the entire audience. It was breakfast. And there were source sheets on the table, which she didn't even read from. She quoted a Gemara, which that she actually did read, and that was valuable to actually see inside. But everything else she did outside, but if you were following on the sheet, you saw that she was exactly but she didn't have the time to do the sources, and I understand that, and it's breakfast. Who gives out source sheets at breakfast? Well, I do. But who gives out source sheets at breakfast? I remember once I spoke to Sudhashmi Sheet in Baltimore at this man's shul, and I was warned, oh, don't use a source sheet. It's not in the culture. So I didn't, because I'm a guest. But Shadi Tarragon this morning, that's exactly what she did. And I must tell you, it was a different keynote address, simply because there was a source sheet on the table, even though she didn't read from it. It sent a different message. The message was, what I'm telling you now is not just a nice hashkafic idea, but there are sources on this. I'm not taking the time to read them now because it's not the forum, but that's what you need to do. I gave a Sudhashmi Sheet, a Shalashuddha's talk in Melbourne, Australia. See, the introduction was true. In Melbourne, Australia, two Shabbases ago, and I used the source sheet. You had scared me, so I like was really nervous about doing it, but I couldn't. I was talking about the difference between Yahshua and Kalev, it was Parsha Shlach, and I needed the textual references to make my point in a way that was going to be powerful. So I gave out a source sheet. Before I gave it out, because this man has me so scared and scarred from the last time I did this, I gave a whole 10-minute introduction that this isn't a shiur. Just because I'm giving out a source sheet, I'm only giving it out because I think it'll be more meaningful to you if you see the references that I'm making. And since you don't have a chumash on the table, why do I have to do that? I have to do that because this is the generation we're raising. So the subliminal message that everything, even if you're not going to use it, is based in a source. When your children ask you a question, you could give the quick, short, I'm busy at work answer, which you have to do, and we're dealing with children. They need answers. That's okay. But I, at least in my family, try to add in the, wow, that's a great question. Here's the short answer. The long answer is, you know, there's a gemara and a thing, and if I have the opportunity even just to pull off a book off the shelf when they ask me a question, just to show them it's inside a book. That extra 2 seconds that it takes to just simply show them that it's in a book, I think, again, in my humble opinion, it's a different generation. I'm sending a different message. And if we continue to do that, we will raise a different generation of kids who don't have a disdain for the text, even though it's not always the appropriate time or message in that particular setting or in that particular age. And therefore, I think this is a demand that we should be having. By the way, I think when a child is trained to give a Dvar Torah at the table, or in NCSY, or in camp, or whatever it is, they should be trained. A Dvar Torah has a message at the end, of course, but it should be rooted first in a Pasuk and Chumash, and not just a story. And this is the pride I have when I have girls who come to school, and at the beginning of the year, we try to get to Dvar Torah on the first Shabbos, and it's always a nice, you know, let me tell you a story. And I don't mean a Hasidic story, I mean like a personal story. But by the end of the year, they could say the exact same message, but it starts with a pasuk and a Rashi and a question on Rashi. It's a different world. But I think that education needs to start younger. Tracks. I don't mean tracking for advanced students. I mean a track. I think we should be demanding from our schools that there be an option, again, structure aside, for those students who we can recruit to actually be in a more text-oriented track, to be in a text-oriented track. Even if that track is small, and therefore there's the financial component of this, how do you invest in an extra teacher for how many students and how do you budget your schools? And if anybody here sits on the board of a school, so I'm sure that's what you're thinking, but at the same time, it's a matter of priorities. Every financial decision we make in a school is a matter of priorities. If it's important enough to you, you'll allocate the funds for it even though there isn't critical mass for it. So I'm not saying it's simple, and I don't run a high school, and I don't run an elementary school, and I don't live in America, and I'm not pretending that I have the answers to all these questions, but I leave it as food for thought. That having been said, I'll add one other thing, incentivizing. If there's an incentive for the text track, or if it's an extracurricular program, let's say in the school setting in that particular community, it won't work. But on a Sunday morning, you know, the Masmidim program like we used to have in camp, etc. I remember, I went to Mar Hashah, there were two of us, and we had an extra Gemara shiur during our free time. Now, I didn't love Gemara as an eighth grader anymore than any other kid. But they were offering something. I don't even remember what it was. But so, oh, and I don't like sports and I don't like swimming, so they're giving out pizza, so okay, I'm there. In other words, incentivizing. And so that's bribing, but if you're bribing for something that's out of the norm, that's not called bribing anymore, that's incentivizing, and we all do it. We give candy to kids when they come to shul so that they'll have a sweet food. So if text is difficult, so if we incentivize. I think that all of this, believe it or not, I hate to pass on the blame, but is the parents. We live in a culture, in an economy culture, in an economy of choice, of supply and demand. If there is a demand for something, the means for the supply will happen. if the parents are not pushing the schools, then why? But the minute they get 16 phone calls that this is a demand, again, suddenly the mathematics and the finances on the equations of how boards allocate their resources, again, I don't have easy answers, but changes. And I think, therefore, accepting this as an issue, really, do my kids go to Israel, for example, and not know how to read a pasuk in Chumash? And I teach advanced women, and they don't know how to read psukim in Chumash? I hate to break the news to you. And kal v'chomer if it's Gemara, and again, we can debate whether boys are better than girls or girls are better than boys on this issue. I'm not so sure about that. But therefore, I do think that it has to start at home. Teachers, high schools, elementary schools, like my story, will claim, thank you very much, we believe in all this, but we don't have the teachers that are, we haven't trained teachers that have, and that is an issue, supply and demand. If there's a demand for the services, the supply will happen. And not only that, the kids who are going into chinuch want jobs. If that's what it takes to get a job, that you need to be textually proficient because you need to be, so then that will be the demand, and then that will be what us, the teacher training schools, have to provide. So long as we, the schools, at the post-high school level, don't have to provide that, because you can get away with just someone who's very nice and good and, you know, etc., and they're going to get a job teaching because they're inspiring, and I don't minimize that. We need to balance this. It's not to negate anything else. So teacher training will happen as part of that as well. High schools will tell you that if I create a track and I pull out, let's say, the four kids that are interested in it, that's not cost effective, but let's say I can solve that, but then I create a scheduling problem. Now I need to have those same four kids in a physics class because the physics class was being offered at the same time as, and it spirals therefore throughout the entire scheduling curriculum and therefore the finances of that, and that is an issue. But again, I will maintain, not that I can solve that, it's a matter of priorities. There's a solution to that problem. I don't know what it is, and I don't know at the expense of what. But just like we prioritize everything else, if we make the option of textual study, and again, that means kids that aren't ready for it don't have to be doing it. But if we don't put it on the list as a priority, we're sending a message to the entire community that this is not important. So even if your child doesn't need it, I believe that it impacts on the entire community. And the last point that I'll make, and then I'll take 2 minutes of questions, Women. Often people will make the decision, hashkafic, educational, or whatever it is, that everything that I've said now is very good for Gemara study, it's very good for boys, we need to make sure that the boys are textually proficient, etc., etc., etc. But who says that the goals that we have for our young girls is the same as the goals that we have for our young boys? And as they move on in advanced education, those goals don't necessarily have to be the same. And that could be a whole different discussion. I personally, and I run a school that have advanced Torah education for women, so I think I put myself out there where I believe on this, but let's go the other approach. Let's just say, l'shitatam, according to the other approach, that there really needs to be and should be a distinction on text versus no text between the men and the women, and therefore when it comes to the girls, it's more important that they have full Yirat Shemayim and that they're good daveners, that they're involved in their chesed, and text study, etc. We could have that argument, we could have that debate, and I can accept the other side even if I personally don't agree with it. But I think what happens then, again, if the whole thing is based on those messages that we're sending to our kids, the boys in that house, that woman's male children, again, Lashita Tam, that male children are getting the message from their mother about a disdain for text. Chinuch in the home, we all know, is at least 50%, and I believe 90%, from the mother. So even if you believe in the other approach, if we're creating a cultural issue, and we're trying to battle a culture, there I believe there has to be no distinction between men and women. The curriculum could be different. That becomes a curriculum question. But as a culture, we're all in the same boat, and therefore I don't think there can be or should be a distinction between men and women, boys and girls, in terms of this issue. I think this is a long process. I think, I have a 100-year plan, I like to say, but when people look at me and they say, so then why are you getting up here and speaking about your 100-year plan when none of us are going to be around anymore to deal with it? I say, I'm in chinuch for the long run. You know, 100 years is nothing in the span of our Jewish history, and if we're building for the future, but we are dealing with a culture that I predict is only going to get worse on this, and therefore this is a pet peeve that I have, and that's why I share. Questions, comments, yes?
When RJJ from the Lower East Side was moving to Staten Island, and there was an elementary school getting started when my son was entering first grade, he had just moved to the community, the parents voted. They really wanted Ivrit Be'Ivrit. And the parents were all in agreement, and they couldn't go Ivrit Be'Ivrit for one reason. They had no rebbeim that were capable of teaching Ivrit Be'Ivrit. Okay, so that's one thing. Second thing, we were once in a cab in Israel, and the cab driver's talking to my husband in Hebrew. And my husband goes, you know, I don't know what you're saying, buddy, you know, like I don't speak Hebrew. And the guy turns around to me and says, you have a kippah on your head, you daven every morning? He said, how do you daven if you don't know what you're saying? You know, 100%. This was it, okay? The other thing that I wanted to say is I went to a very right-wing Beis Yaakov, and believe it or not, I mean, with the exception, we didn't do things like Gemara, of course, but you would not believe how textually based our learning was. And those of us that came from the Borough Park Division had had several Israeli Talmidei Chachamot, like you would not believe. We were proficient in both Hebrew and textual learning, unlike the girls that came from Williamsburg, let's say, who said it's either Yiddish or English, don't bother us with Hebrew.
100%. So I'll just make two comments on that. Number one, although we focus often on Hebrew, and that it's easier to focus on, it's not. This isn't limited to the Hebrew is, of course, the major example. It's not just Hebrew, it's text. Hebrew also, and text is language connected, so those things overlap, but it's text. The disdain for the text, even if it's being taught Anglit, but the concept of, oh, I'm going to read a Ramban. It's hard work. Just tell me what it says. Or what's the halakha? Instead of looking it up or showing. So, you know, when I, Maisa Shahaya from this Shabbos, a girl asked me a question about something that she saw in camp. So I could have just said to her, oh, by the way, I know you think that what the camp was doing is inappropriate, but it actually is, you're just not used to it, but it's really, in Europe, that's the way they do it still to this day, and it's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I could have given her that answer, which I did, because you need an answer. But I also went and pulled the Mishnah Berurah off the shelf at a different, you know, at a different time when I wasn't with her, and I came back to her 20 minutes later, and I said to her, by the way, make sure you look it up. It's Reish Lamed Hei in Shulchan Aruch, and it references Reish Lamed Gimel. Now, I don't know if she's ever going to go look it up. I don't know if she's ever going to remember that it's Reish Lamed Hei and Reish Lamed Gimel. I would hope that she would, or email me that, where was this? I don't know. Subliminal message. I answered her question. I made her feel better about her camp experience, something that she thought the camp was doing inappropriate, which was totally, in, at least in my opinion, fine. But it's a source.
By the way, my son-in-law, who's still sitting and learning in Kolo after 15 years of marriage, who's in Rabbi Shlomo, when his daughter, who's 13, asks him a question, he pulls out Mishnah Berurah,
exactly,
whatever, right off the shelf.
Exactly. So that's my point. And the other comment that I will just make, you mentioned about the Beis Yaakov movement. I believe that's true from my experience. Often, this isn't a right-wing, left-wing divide. Often in the Beis Yaakov world, they actually are excellent, at least again, the small limited sample that I see, are excellent in this regard. And if that's the case, then that proves this doesn't have to become a hashgafic battle between different camps. And then I ask all of us, again, I'm sitting in the five towns, so I'll use the five towns as an example, in the modern Orthodox schools and in the modern Orthodox world, if that's true, what messages are we sending our kids? Are we sending them a message of study for tests, pressure, you know, et cetera, grades, you know, et cetera, even in their Judaic studies, but are we teaching them how to read? Are we teaching them how to think? Are we making that a priority that Judaism is substantive and not just a bunch of nice ideas? And that I'm not 100% sure. Yes?
Hi. Welcome.
Hi.
I'm primarily an elementary school teacher, even though I teach all levels, because I have private tutoring service, so I get Limudei Kodesh and Limudei Kol, which I have to address. On the elementary classroom level, which is what I want to discuss right now, there are three things working against this concept, which is so important that you point down. Number one are class sizes. They have been very large, especially in the fundamental grades of first and second grade. Therefore, I find that Hebrew reading, which is entirely phonetically based, is never totally covered. When children come to second and third grade, they're just not adequate readers. And that's number one. Number two is the attention span of this generation is mind-bogglingly low. I think it's because they're used to, snapping,
no doubt
about it, instant, and we have to be singing and dancing in front of the classroom. We have to be all over at one time. And I believe that adds to it because Hebrew is another language, no matter how you package it. And the third thing I wanted to say is the level of derech eretz of this generation has so deteriorated that it's almost like I have to prove why I have a right to be standing in front of the classroom. I believe that those three points, the class size, the attention span, and the lack of Derech Eretz directly impact on the elementary school level to the concept that you have that is also important?
So I'll just comment. I believe all those things are for sure true. My only comment on that will be that's true outside of the Judaic studies realm as well. And we can only solve what we can solve, and we can only deal culturally with what we can culture. We can't rewire kids who have already been rewired, etc. That is for sure true. However, if we're willing to tackle the problem in English reading, because we know that that's going to be the ticket for their success in college, the colleges haven't lowered, although that's not true. The colleges tell me that they've lowered their standards as well. So I get that, and I accept that. But we as parents don't accept that, whatever that means. Why are we willing to accept, and we, again, my experience is that as parents, we are willing to accept lower standards in their Judaic studies, which I don't think is healthy. So that's my comment on that. In terms of class sizes, I certainly hear that, but I want to remind you all you're talking to an Israeli, so I would kill for your class sizes. My kids are going in class sizes of 40 kids in a classroom. 40.
And it's community?
It's every community. It's all of Israel is like that. Again, it's a financial, you know, et cetera, in Israel we all know. It's 40 kids in a classroom. I believe today, I don't know if it went through, the schools went on, there's still school, it's only June 28th, went on strike today over this issue. And in Israel we haven't solved it, but ironically somehow one thing about Israel, you can put pros and cons of different educational systems, and the language there is their native language, so it changes everything. I accept all of that, but somehow despite classroom sizes in Israel, my children actually got it, again the language is certainly the factor, but got an education. The Israeli educational system, the British educational system, not so much in talking, saying, is so much stronger than the American educational system that we can't change the overall American educational system. That's not what we're here to do. But within those limitations, I think recognizing the problem is a first step. Yes?
So impressed with your three main points. And you repeat them.
Yeah, can you repeat them?
Subliminal messages. It doesn't matter if you're going to see direct results immediately. You won't. But creating a culture of sources being important. Am I saying this right?
Yeah, yeah.
Sources, and of tracking, and you said of incentives. Okay, but what I'm saying, high school, right wing, somewhat right wing, maybe because of the attention, maybe because of the lack of skills, maybe because of their lack of love of words anymore.
Yes.
Reading language, I teach communication, I teach Yadus. I can't get them to work hard.
Yeah.
Addressing a work ethic.
Well,
you
true.
Have the schwitz. I'm saying even with, we're finding the phenomenon of the very bright wanting to opt out for easier, quicker degrees, go to a seminary in Eretz Yisrael that's, I don't want to go there, I don't want to work so hard.
Yeah, believe me, that phenomenon I know. Those are the girls who don't come to mine. I know those girls.
You know, it's like, right. Do it quick, do it fast.
That is definitely a phenomenon. Without getting into the Hashkafic discussion, from where I sit, I do see that phenomenon more in the more right-wing world than in the left-wing world, but it is a cultural phenomenon. But kids that are going to Columbia and kids that are working their tail off to be able to go to Harvard and Penn, and there are kids like that, they're not doing the quickie degrees.
Right.
The average kid, again, this is in the secular world also, the average kid is spending more years in school because everybody now needs to go to graduate school. So if you do a quickie undergrad, I can respect the quickie undergrad because everything happens.
Undergrad is high school now.
Exactly. Everything's
happening
in graduate school anyway, so we can debate the need
exactly.
for undergrad, you know, in general. That's why I say the British system and the European system where there is no undergrad and you're straight into your thing, and those kids are actually getting, a better education than what America is providing in general, but and quicker and cheaper. So I raise that to the the Board of Education.
I bring in sources, and I do it. I'm with you. I'm really with you. I do it anyway. I bring in sources, I lose them.
So it's marketing. You need to market sources. Sometimes you have to, but it's again, you're starting with subliminal messages, so it's going to take a few years. But if you start giving out a source sheet and you don't read it, I know that sounds really stupid.
I do it.
But right.
I do it.
So, right.
Firstly, because I feel they know I'm credible. I want them to know that I don't bring things out of the air, as you were saying. I always ask them a car, or it has, whatever.
And you never. I often will use a source sheet, even though I don't have time to use it in the setting. But I'll say to them, by the way, you don't have the time. But if you are interested, I have given you all the sources. There might be one kid in that room out of 100 children that I gave that will actually go back and read it, and whatever. But I changed that kid. So again, it's going to be one kid at a time, and that's what we have to do. But
how do you get them to? fits.
Ah, tell me, and then I'll make sure my kids do it too. Yes.
I was going to say, you know, first thing is, I actually came to this year because it was you. I'm on the board of a school, and I'm actually going to go back. I'm on the education committee as well as the board, and I'm going to talk to them about it, so I do appreciate your share. But I want to say, when my daughter looked at your school, she said to me, if I don't learn how to read now and read a text now, how am I ever going to know later? Because if I don't take the advantage of learning how to read for 2 hours, you know, right. And that really, the base metrics portion of it really said she needs to learn how to learn now.
The average kid doesn't buy into that. So I'm glad your daughter did, but the average kid doesn't buy into that. We have to end, right?
The next one's starting in less than a minute.
So then we have to, but you can ask me Friday.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Thank you.
I just want to give you that. It's number 7.
Oh, who I just saw. I saw her shoes. We were walking on the street, and there she was with your grand talking going.
Yes, thank you very much.
So I just want to tell you, in years before she walked on YouTube video.